from the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean. Good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to this remarkable program we call Coast to Coast AM. Later on tonight, we'll discuss the theory of ETs and government abductions with Melinda Leslie. Should be a fascinating program. Here's what's happening. A $302 billion transportation bill apparently gives federal regulators the power to enter the premises of car dealerships simply to determine if their vehicles are in compliance with the federal fuel economy mandates. The Department of Transportation could see its vehicle inspection authority expanded if Congress passes the Grow America Act. Currently, DOT officials are not allowed to inspect records and information from companies that must comply with federal fuel economy standards. But the bill would allow federal bureaucrats to enter the premises of car dealerships to physically inspect to see if the vehicles are in compliance with the federal fuel economy standards. And maybe after that, though it's not in the bill, maybe they'll go into your garage and check out your car too. Ukraine's acting president has reinstated military conscription. Now, that's compulsory enrollment in the military, almost like a draft, to deal with deteriorating security in the east of that country. The move came as pro-Russia militants seized the regional prosecutor's office in an eastern city. Ukraine blames Russia for organizing the seizures of a number of offices in the east. Moscow says, hey, we don't have anything to do with this. Some 40,000 Russian troops are stationed near the Ukrainian border. Jerome Corsi, of course, who writes for the WND.com. Jerry, I want your perspective on the entire Ukrainian situation.
Well, George, clearly Russia has a strategic interest in Ukraine and also Crimea. I mean, Crimea is now with Russia. And it's very much like Hitler, step by step, you know, with Austria and Czechoslovakia, argued that these were German-speaking peoples in the 30s, 1938, you know, prior to invading Poland. The same logic is going with Putin and Russia, that certain sections of Ukraine are Russian-speaking and Russian-allied. And so, you know, it's kind of like the salami tactic of, you know, step-by-step breaking it up piece by piece. Russia is saying, well, we're going to move into or take over, or these are Russian-speaking Ukrainians, and we have a right to repatriate them to Russia. And that's what's going on. I think it's going to be an unstoppable move where eventually Russia has the pretext, the reason to say, now we're going to militarily invade and protect our Russian-speaking Ukrainians.
That's a tense situation. I talked with Professor Stephen Cohen last night, Jerry, on the program, and, well, he's not sure if it's going to erupt or not, but he does say it's a very tense situation.
I think it's likely to erupt because, again, Russia's applying pressure, and step by step, you know, you've got these internal so-called revolts or takeovers by Russian-speaking Ukrainians, and the whole logic of this is that Russia eventually moves in and takes over.
That's right. Jerry, let's stay in touch with each other on that. Magma levels are slowly rebuilding inside Mount St. Helens, a volcano in Washington state that erupted back in 1980, killed 57 people then, although there is no sign, they say, of an impending eruption. And a prehistoric Atlantis in the North Sea may have been abandoned after being hit by a 15-foot tsunami 8,200 years ago. The wave was generated by a catastrophic subsea landslide off the coast of Norway. By the way, get up to coasttocoastam.com. Take a look at the story on the Mars outfit. That's right, the new suit, the spacesuit that NASA is designing for folks who will go to Mars. Go take a look at that. Malaysia Airlines has asked relatives of passengers on board flight MH370 to leave the hotel accommodation that it has been providing and simply return to their homes. It is closing the family assistance centers set up after the plane vanished on March 8th with 239 people on board. The airline promised to keep relatives up to date on the search operation. And who's been keeping us up to date? James Sanders, author of The Downing of TWA Flight 800. Well, we're coming up on that ominous May 2nd date, Jim, that you keep talking about. What do you think?
Well, we'll know in less than 24 hours whether this was a sophisticated operation or not. If it was, it'll be worldwide news. I continue to believe that the operation going on in Yemen is attached to the real search for that plane, because just today, a wire service report out of Yemen said two things. One, that this is an unprecedented operation by U.S. forces down there. That's significant. Mm-hmm. And the other is they think they might have, they're not sure, but they might have gotten the Al-Qaeda bomb expert, which that would be very important for 777, obviously. Yeah.
And for a lot of people don't know, May 2nd, the anniversary date of bin Laden's killing, and when we stormed the compound in Pakistan. Yeah, it's, you know, Jim, it's a interesting theory. It's very possible. I wanted to get your reaction to that company that said that they may have found a plane in the Bay of Bengal, but it's being refuted.
Yeah, I tend to doubt it, but I, you know, and anything's possible, because you just don't get very good information off of the what I consider the pretend search down there. That'll sort itself out pretty soon. But it's more logical than being down to the south. The south is such an incredibly illogical place for the plane to be. At least there's some logic for it to be up where this other outfit says it might be.
Yeah. All right, Jim, we'll monitor that situation. Thank you for everything you've done with us on this story. When you picture Egypt's pyramids rising over the country's sands, your vision likely does not include water, does it? Well, it should. According to a new study published online, the University of Amsterdam researchers found that the ancient Egyptians employed what they call a clever trick to facilitate the pyramid's construction. They likely wet the sand along the path that they dragged their sledge, which were laden with pyramid stones weighing some 2.5 tons, greatly lessening the power needed to pull the sledge from the quarry to the construction site. I still think that they had some other means for moving those blocks. And a story that we're going to check in with Michael Cremo about in just a moment. Neanderthals were not inferior to modern humans, according to a study. So if you think they were stupid and primitive, think again. The widely held notion that the Neanderthals were dim-witted and that their inferior intelligence allowed them to be driven to extinction by the much brighter ancestors of modern humans is not supported by scientific evidence, according to a researcher at the University of Colorado in Boulder. So up next, Michael Cremo, author of Forbidden Archaeology, joins us on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. Noted author and Coast to Coast regular and researcher Michael Cremo, several of his works, Forbidden Archaeology, Human Devolution, of course. We're going to talk about this story for the next couple hours, much broader than just the Neanderthal study, but that they were not inferior to modern humans. What'd you think of that study, Michael?
Well, I'm familiar with some of that work. What the authors of the recent study did is summarize a lot of the scientific evidence that's accumulated over the past couple of decades, showing that the creatures that we call Neanderthals were not just brutish, dumb, stupid, cave-dwelling ape men. They appear to have a lot of abilities that we recognize as characteristic of our human species. So, you know, for example, they found over the past couple of decades that the Neanderthals deliberately buried their dead. In other words, they must have had some kind of conception of the afterlife.
That's right.
Or
That's
something
a good
like
point.
That.
Yeah.
And there was a famous case from the Shanidar Cave, which is now in Iraq, where in the 1960s, a Neanderthal burial was discovered by archaeologists, and they found huge amounts of flower pollen in the area where the skeletons were excavated, indicating that there had perhaps been offerings of flowers to the dead. So it shows they had some compassion. It shows they may have had some conception of an afterlife. And these are characteristics of human cognitive behavior. There are other examples. For example, they have found tools, stone tools, characteristic of the Neanderthals on islands in the Mediterranean, on Crete, for example, which is a big island, but also on several smaller Greek islands in the Aegean Sea. And these stone tools are called Mousterian stone tools. That's a stone tool industry that is characteristic of the Neanderthals, who existed from about 300,000 years ago to about 30 or 40,000 years ago, according to the mainstream theories. And these particular stone tools that were found on these Greek islands were about 100,000 or 110,000 years old. So they're characteristic of the Neanderthals. They're Mousterian stone tools, and they're found on islands. Well, how did these ape men get to these islands? They must have made some kind of boat and deliberately sailed across the ocean to reach these Greek islands. So there again, you have something that most people would consider characteristic of human intelligence. So there's it's also been shown by genetic studies that modern human populations living today have some of the DNA from Neanderthals. They've been able to, you know, when they've excavated some Neanderthal bones, they've been able to extract DNA from it. And they can tell that living populations of humans today have up to 4% Neanderthal DNA, which is the equivalent of having a great-great-great grandparent that was a Neanderthal. So I think there's not such a big line of division between the Neanderthals, the creatures that we call Neanderthals, and humans of our type. Now, people, scientists, used to make a big distinction between the modern human type, Homo sapiens sapiens, and the Neanderthals, Homo neanderthalensis.
Like there was this massive difference.
Well, they used to think like that. For example, they would look at the skulls, and they would see that Neanderthal skulls would have these big eye ridges, eyebrows, bony ridges above their eye sockets. You know, if most of us, if we, you know, feel the forehead above the eye sockets, it's smooth.
Yeah.
But actually, there's a certain percentage of people living today who have these bony ridges over their eyes. So there are living humans that have the same characteristics as the Neanderthal skulls that are found in excavations in Asia and Africa and Europe.
No, that's a good point, Michael. There are some humans who somewhat look prehistoric sometimes. I mean, we come across them. And, you know, their brothers and sisters may look like modern humans, but they've got that little difference. How does that happen?
Well, I think our modern human species has much more variety in it than we normally think possible. So a lot of the characteristics that we normally identify with these earlier species, there are living humans that have them too. So it creates a problem in trying to identify species. Maybe our species concept is a little fuzzier than we thought it was. that it's not so easy to make distinctions between humans living today and humans living in the past. Pretty much I've always thought this, that just as today we've got a wide range of humans in terms of size and shape, and if you throw into the mix all the evidence there is for living what we might call ape men in terms of Sasquatch and Bigfoot and things like that, we see we've got quite a bit of diversity on this planet. And I think that similarly in the past, there has always been quite a bit of diversity. Now, because of the commitment of most scientists to the Darwinian theory of evolution, they want to make it seem like everyone who existed in the past must have been more primitive and less advanced. So it's kind of interesting that even the mainstream scientists are beginning to deconstruct that myth that in the past everything was more primitive. Now they're looking at the Neanderthals, some of these scientists, and saying, actually, they were more intelligent than we used to think. So I think that's a positive step in the right direction.
Is it a dramatic step, Michael?
I would say it is. But to really come to terms with the concept that people in the distant past were actually quite advanced, they've still got a long way to go. I think gradually science, even mainstream science, is taking little tiny steps in the right direction. When we actually look at the accounts that we find in ancient wisdom traditions about what people were like, even millions of years ago, we find descriptions in the ancient Sanskrit writings, for example, of fabulous cities, of spacecraft like the Vimanas that I sometimes talk about.
Yes, and we'll talk about that after the break too. That's fascinating.
Plus, yeah, so I would say it's not revolutionary what they're doing right now, but it's positive. It's a positive step in the right direction, but they've got a long way to go, I think, until they are fully able to comprehend how advanced people were in past ages.
You know, the story I just had, Michael, before you came on, a researcher in Boulder, Colorado, is theorizing that the pyramids were built when they moved, they were able to move the 2.5 tons of block on sleds by putting water on the sand to kind of make it slippery. But it had to be a certain amount. You couldn't put too much or it would sink. You know, it'd be sludgy. I still think they missed the boat on this. There's some other way they built these pyramids. There's
I agree with you on that. I think, of course, right now, the way that science is constructed is they try to explain everything in terms of the ordinary laws of physics. In other words, they think, okay, these blocks of stone weighed so much, and the only way people could move them would be by applying some kind of physical force in the normal way, either by using a certain number of human slaves, you know, to pull them on sleds, or maybe having some more other type of simple technology to do it. But they may have been able to do things by other methods. If we look at the ancient wisdom traditions, they tell about being able to manipulate things by sound vibration, by mantras, so they may have had more subtle technologies involving advances that are just beyond our current abilities in order to accomplish some of these things.
Michael, we're going to take this break, then I want to come back. I want to talk with you about some other things that you did in your incredible work, Forbidden Archaeology. The Baghdad battery, for example, what an incredible discovery. A battery back thousands and thousands of years ago. What did they use it for? And then did they have flying machines? We'll talk about that, too, when we come right back. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. We'll take calls next hour with Michael Cremo. Michael, you brought up Vermont as you've done a lot of work. Tell us, first of all, to those who have no idea what they are, and what you were able to discover.
Vimana is a Sanskrit word from the ancient Sanskrit writings of India. It means spacecraft or flying craft. And in the ancient Sanskrit writings of India, especially the Puranas, which are the historical writings, there are many descriptions of these spacecraft or Vimanas. Some of them were made of ordinary metal, and some of them were made apparently of more subtle energies that were capable of interdimensional travel. There's an elaborate description of a Vimana that was used to attack a city on Earth called Dwarka, which is in northwestern India. And about 5,000 years ago, according to the text, the city was attacked by a flying craft made of metal that was raining down weapons on the city and eventually was shot down and crashed into the ocean off the coast of India. So they're very interesting descriptions, and accompanying them, these craft apparently had really interesting flying abilities.
Great capabilities, right?
Yeah, it's described that this particular craft that was attacking the city of Dwarka could appear simultaneously in many different places. Sometimes you would just see one craft, sometimes you would see many, so that you couldn't tell where the actual craft was. And this is something that's done by modern militaries and electronic warfare. When they're sending an aircraft or a missile warhead towards an enemy country, they are able to create duplicate images of the aircraft or missile warhead on the enemy radar so that they're not able to really detect which is the actual warhead and shoot it down. So apparently this technology existed long ago in ancient India. So they're really fascinating accounts. So a lot of things that are being reported by modern UFO researchers were taking place even thousands of years ago.
How do we know, Michael, whether the Vimanas were from outside planetary system sources, ETs, or were earthbound from a very sophisticated earth-like society?
I don't think one thing rules out the other. You know, just like we have our aircraft today, but there are apparently craft visiting from other parts of the universe as well. Even, you know, modern archaeologists are starting to talk about such things. You know, I've attended several meetings of the World Archaeological Congress, which is the world's largest international organization of archaeologists. And in some of their past meetings, they've had sessions on extraterrestrial archaeology where they talk about what would happen if we found orbiting the Earth spacecraft or satellites that we didn't send up. So even mainstream scientists are already speaking about these things.
Uh-oh, and there's talk that there is a satellite up there that could be thousands of years old, and it's not from us.
That's the kind of thing that they're talking about behind closed doors at some of these scientific conferences.
There is a battery that they found in Baghdad, in Iraq, that is thousands of years old. What the heck was it used for?
Well, what they're talking about there is archaeologists found ceramic jars that had inside of them a cylinder of copper and a rod of iron. And these are can be used for electrolysis. If you had filled up, you know, these metals, copper and iron, they have electrolytic properties. In other words, they can be sources of positive and negative charges. If the ceramic jars containing these copper cylinders and iron rods had been filled with a liquid, an acidic type of liquid, like, you know, for example, vinegar or something like that, they would generate an electric charge. And some archaeologists have speculated that perhaps these batteries were used for electroplating objects with gold or silver, for example. This is a technique that wasn't invented in the modern world until a couple of centuries ago. But apparently these people in ancient Baghdad had these abilities. Another thing that came to my attention recently is from the same part of the world, from ancient Assyria, which is now in the modern country of Iraq. It's called the Nimrod Lens. In the 19th century, there was a British archaeologist named Austin Henry Layard. He was excavating the palace of King Nimrod in ancient Assyria, and he found in the course of his excavations a lens made of rock crystal, clear rock crystal, which is sort of like glass. And this lens was studied by Sir David Brewster, who was a British physicist, and he remarked that it was ground in such a way that it could serve for magnification. And within the past few years, an Italian scientist from the University of Rome, Dr. Giuseppe Pettinato, studied this lens and concluded it was probably part of a telescope that the ancient Assyrian people had used. Now, according to the normal way of looking at things, you know, telescopes were invented around 1500 or 1600 or something like that. But this lens is 3,000 years old. And the ancient Assyrians apparently had knowledge that Saturn had rings, which is something that you can't perceive with the naked eye. You need a telescope to observe the rings of Saturn. They would depict Saturn in their ancient Assyrian tablets, stone tablets or clay tablets, with a serpent going around its equator, which obviously is an indication of the rings of Saturn. So, you know, we were just talking in the beginning of the show how we may have to change our concept about how intelligent the Neanderthals were. Well, we may also have to change some of our concepts about how much scientific knowledge and technical knowledge people of ancient civilizations had.
You know, I always questioned, Michael, the ancients, because I always said, you know, where are the remnants of their huge skyscrapers and big cities and everything? And then I came across really two things over the years. One, as you know, that skyscrapers made of glass and metal disintegrate over time. And, you know, over thousands and hundreds of thousands of years, it would be rubble and dust. But the other thing that made me realize that maybe they didn't have to have these big cities, the Star Wars movie, and they're coming out in December of 2015 with, you know, number 7. But
with some of the original stars.
You know, they with the original stars too, that's right. But their homes and buildings in those movies were stone huts. Yet they had the incredible sophistication of craft and, you know, flying saucers and everything else. So maybe the ancients didn't have to possess the kinds of skyscrapers and buildings we have today. Maybe they were just all made out of stone, but they had the technology.
Yeah, I think that's definitely possible. We can't judge everything by the standard of what we observe today. Apparently, it was also like that in the past. The ancient Sanskrit writings have descriptions of big cities, but they're not the kinds of cities that we have today. In other words, today we have skyscrapers made of glass and steel and concrete. They had beautiful garden-like cities with beautiful buildings made of marble and precious stone and things like that, with lots of gardens and things like that, not like downtown New York or Moscow or Paris or London. So I think you're absolutely right about that, George, that the ancient civilizations may have had a different standard of living than we are accustomed to today. They may have made use of other technologies. They may have made use of more subtle energies. They may have been able to have a nice standard of life without a lot of the drawbacks that our current urban industrial civilization has.
Just remarkable. Of everything you've investigated, Michael, is there that one aspect of it that still boggles your mind?
Well, what really boggles my mind is that there's so much of this evidence that has just been filtered out of our mainstream thinking, the mainstream scientific institutions and the mainstream educational system, so that the only way that people can even get a hint of this is to listen to a show like Coast to Coast or some of the documentaries that come on some of the more forward-thinking cable channels, and or if people would go to an alternative science conference or something like that. So to me, that is what is really most amazing.
Well, there's no doubt about that. And with the ancients, you have thought that we could be 100 million years old.
Well, yeah, that takes us way back. Of course, we were talking about the Neanderthals, but I think a human presence goes back far, far beyond that. And even recently, science has been taking some baby steps in that direction. Earlier this year, they announced the discovery of human footprints at a place called Happisburg in northeastern England, on the coast there. Archaeologists were noticing, the winter storms were washing away the different layers of sand and rock, and they exposed some areas of rock that had impressions, little impressions on them. And when the archaeologists looked a little closer, they realized they were human footprints, and they think they're about 900,000 years old. Now, the mainstream archaeologists, they don't believe that humans like us were existing, at that time, 900,000 years ago. So they attributed them to an ape-man human ancestor they call Homo antecessor, that they've discovered in caves in Spain. But when they measured the footprints, they found, in terms of their size and their shape, they're within the modern human range. So I don't see any necessity to attribute them to anything other than a human being like us. The footprints look like the footprints that you and I would leave if we were walking on a beach today, and they are 900,000 years old. Now, they think today, the mainstream idea among archaeologists is that humans like us came into existence less than 200,000 years ago. But they're reporting evidence like this. They're not really understanding it because of their knowledge filter, but the reports are there. I mean, dozens of people sent me copies of this particular report because they can understand what it meant. Just an ordinary person could understand what it meant, that humans like us were existing 900,000 years ago. But as I said, that's just a tiny step in the right direction. There's actually footprint evidence that humans were existing hundreds of millions of years ago. You know, for example, the shoe print that was found by William Meister at Antelope Springs in Utah.
Is that with a dinosaur print?
Well, this case is not that case.
Okay.
There are other cases like this. This was, he was a fossil collector. He was going out into the desert and picking up pieces of stone. He had this little geological hammer, you know, to break the pieces of stone in half. And one piece of stone he broke in half, and when he broke it in half, there was revealed in one of the parts of the stone a shoe print, not a naked footprint, but an actual shoe print. And crushed was a shellfish called a trilobite, which is characteristic of a very early period in the history, the geological history of the Earth, that goes back over 500 million years. So there's footprint evidence that goes back much further than even, you know, the 900,000 years of the recent discoveries that were made in England. So it is really mind-blowing how far back the evidence for a human presence on this planet really goes.
Michael, what happened to the lost knowledge? I mean, regardless of whether civilizations were 100,000 years older, 2 million, 100, why was it lost?
Well, it's apparently not all lost. Some of it survives either in the ancient wisdom traditions, which are there to remind us of the knowledge that great civilizations on this planet once had. And there may even be surviving bits of it that have come down to us somehow or other to the present day. But now it's very much marginalized and out of the mainstream. I think it is still there.
And I guess you got to look for it.
It's got to find you, or you've got to find it.
What happened in terms of knowledge that allowed us to jump in various spots? I mean, we went from the 1800s to the 1900s with this dramatic increase of knowledge, and then from the 1900s to 2000, just incredible. Why did it take so long to get to those points?
I think a lot of what you've seen in the past couple of centuries is our attempts to reduplicate abilities people once had naturally. I think a lot of the advances that we've seen have been in communications. You know, we've developed radio and television and smartphones and all types of things like that. But I think that's our attempt to reduplicate telepathy, remote viewing, and things like that.
Michael, we're going to take some phone calls with you next on Coast to Coast AM.